Oh, that's right. We're right here this afternoon. How you doing? Looks like we're going to get a thunder boomer or two, so I'm not sure how Gracie's going to do this afternoon, but we're here. We also are very fortunate to have Ellen Weaver. She is president and CEO of the Palmetto Policy Forum, and she brings a lot of past experience. For 12 years, she worked for U.S. Senator Jim DeMint, both in Washington and in South Carolina, and she has done speech writing, fundraising, and now that she has her own business with the Palmetto Policy Forum, you do even more of that, don't you, Ellen?
It never ends. It's kind of funny how no experience is ever wasted. I didn't understand why I was doing all of the things that I was doing in Senator DeMint's office. Now I know.
Well, I think it's terrific. Let's see, you've been doing this for over a year now.
Just over a year. So I can't believe it's been a year since I was last in studio with you, but we've passed our first anniversary since then in February. And it's exciting to really feel like we're not doing everything for the first time anymore. You feel in the first year like you're pushing uphill the entire way. And now the ball is starting to roll on its own a little bit, which is a good feeling.
Sure. And when you do something, you know, you have some idea of the results you can expect.
That's exactly right. And, you know, even since we talked to you last time, the legislature was in recess. They've come back in January. And there are several ideas that we've researched that are actually moving through the State House right now. And that's exciting to see, to feel like you're not just working in a vacuum, but you're actually putting out ideas that are being picked up and carried.
Well, that is exciting. Now, I know that there's a lot of topics you would like to talk about. And, of course, one of the big ones that we keep hearing about, left and right, Common Core, to have or not to have, that is the question.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge controversy. And unlike some, I actually see an opportunity, a couple of opportunities in Common Core if we address it correctly. The first is you have parents who are more engaged because of the Common Core debate in what is happening in their local schools than I've seen in a long time. And at the end of the day, the policies that we're advocating for here at the forum are about empowering parents with choices and control over the education of their child. And agree or disagree with Common Core, I think that the energy that this discussion has generated is an energy that we need to harness in talking about other ideas that can move forward expanding options in South Carolina. The second huge opportunity that I think it presents to us as a state is the attention that it's focused on how we govern or don't govern our schools here in South Carolina. There is such an assorted hodgepodge of accountability, whether it's the State Board of Education, the superintendent, the EOC, the governor's office, who's responsible for what? It's hard to follow the paper trail in, you know, determining.
That's why I guess we need the federal government to do it all,
oh,
right?
Oh, clearly, right. Yeah. Because they're so, they've demonstrated such competence in everything else that they do, whether it's cash for clunkers or the stimulus or whatever else they've lent their hand to. But I think that this is an opportunity to have a conversation in South Carolina about how we streamline our education governance in a way that is accountable and makes sense, and how we return more control and decisions to parents at the local level.
Sure. And of course, you know, we talk about what is the local level and how can our students compete, not only, as we were talking before we came on the air, from a local perspective, but across this country, the United States of America, and then globally. So how do you set standards that local people have the control over, but still put it out there on a national and international level?
Well, one of the metaphors that we used in a report that we put out called How Common Core Went Wrong, I think makes a lot of sense and brings some clarity to this whole discussion, because I think there's a lot of confusion about what Common Core is and what it does. So it goes something like this, and this is not original with me. It's an education scholar named Peter Cunningham who came up with this, but he said, the standard, which is what Common Core is, it's a standard, is the bar that students must jump over to be competitive. The curriculum is the training program that coaches use to help students get over that bar. The assessment is the track meet where we find out how high everyone can jump, and the accountability system is what follows after it's all over, and we want to figure out what went right, what went wrong, and what it will take to help kids jump higher. So I think that it is important that we have a standard of what our children in South Carolina need to learn. However, that standard has to be unequivocally controlled at the state level. We do not need to cede that to Washington. We were talking before we went on air about how Washington's involvement in education matters has certainly not done anything to improve outcomes. If you look at where we were in 1970 versus where we are now, I think we can all agree that federal involvement in state education has been an unmitigated failure. And so I think that having
He who has the gold makes the golden rule, right?
That's exactly right. And that's why we were actually encouraged to see that Superintendent Zase pulled South Carolina out of the Smarter Balanced Common Core Testing Consortium, which was federally funded. Our contention at the forum is that whoever pays for and controls the test is ultimately going to control what's taught in classrooms. So Superintendent Zase pulling us out of Smarter Balanced, as well as legislation that's moving through the House and Senate that would do the same thing, is an important piece of this puzzle. And I think it's a great first step when we talk about how South Carolina is going to remain in control of our standards. Now, when it comes to returning more control to the district and local level, that's where curriculum comes in. So we've talked about where standards play a role. You know, that's the bar that the students have to jump over.
Right.
The curriculum is how you actually get them to that point, how you train them. And districts are free to choose their own curriculum. And we think that that's where parents should be very involved. Local schools, local school boards, and school districts should be in charge of making the decision about what is taught in their local schools that will help their students achieve the standards that are going to make them competitive.
You know, one of the things that I think if we just, those that have been homeschooled have always had that as what they had to do, mm-hmm. correct? I mean, yeah. A homeschooler had to be able to pass those tests at the end of the, but how they went about getting the information spoon-fed or however into the student was their responsibility.
And this really goes to the heart of our education philosophy at the Forum, which is that every child can learn, but every child's learning needs are unique. I am the product of a hybrid learning structure. I went to private school, kindergarten through fifth grade. I was homeschooled 6th through 10th grade. And then I went to public school, 11th and 12th grade. And my,
you seem pretty normal.
Yeah, see, exactly. So this isn't, you know, in any way an attack on public schools. I think we have some great public schools. We certainly have incredible, dedicated teachers, principals, and administrators in our public school system. But the fact is that one size just doesn't fit all. And even within the learning lifetime of an individual student, those needs can change. And so we think that parents should have as many high-quality options. Parents of every socioeconomic level should have as many high quality options as possible for their child.
So we're going to be talking about some of the Common Core. I think we're going to get into some other issues too. You know, maybe something with, what was that? I saw something about the IRS targets free speech. I mean, you know, I see a lot of things here. Education news, two steps forward, one step back. We're going to be talking about all these different things here with Ellen Weaver. And as I said, she is president and CEO of the Palmetto Policy Forum. You may have seen her at a meeting. You may have seen some of the stuff that she puts out and her organization puts out. But it's a growing organization, and it is designed to help the individual decide how to educate as far as education concerns. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we can get so bogged down and we get information from so many sources. Your mind can just go, you know, I give up. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of parents, sometimes they don't want to give up, but they just don't know what direction to go.
Well, it's funny you say that because, you know, I'm actually at an age where a lot of my peers have young children and they're trying to decide, what am I going to do for my child's education? And that's actually how one of our key resources was born since I was here last time. It's called Empowering Students, Education Options for South Carolina Families. And it's a very straightforward catalog that we've put out. It's available on our website, which is palmettopolicy.org, and it lists all of the different options that are currently available for parents in South Carolina. We couldn't believe that nobody had pulled this information together before, but what we do is we tell the story of a South Carolina family who is in a charter school, who is using online schooling, who is homeschooling, and who is going to a private school.
They have no time for anything else, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How this option is working working for their family, and then we give parents links to resources to learn more about whether that option might be right for them. And it's just kind of a one-stop shop for parents, boils it all down into a very concise, readable format that just gives them a place to start as they start their research. And that's what we want to be at the forum. I think when sometimes you hear about a policy organization, you think about 20-page white papers that, you know, gather dust on a shelf and nobody ever reads. But our job is really to try to make things accessible for people so that they can understand the issues in a fair and balanced way, to borrow a phrase,
right,
and act accordingly.
Sure. So we are here with Ellen this afternoon for the whole hour. If you have a question, don't hesitate to give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here. Sharp Facets Gallery. Gracie, go lay down now. We're back on the air. I know it's short breaks, isn't it? Yes, Mom, it sure is. Well, we are here with Ellen Weaver. She is another pet mom, so we have a lot that we have in common here to talk about.
My dogs are going to be very jealous when I go home smelling like Gracie.
Gracie, yes. Well, Gracie feels that she scored one for Gracie there. Exactly. Well, you know, we just had a couple of call-ins to Ellen, and one of the things that people are a little confused about, are you running for public office, or what is this Palmetto Policy Forum? What actually started Palmetto Policy Forum?
Oh, heavens. Let me say, first of all, no, unequivocally, I am not running for public office. I worked for Senator DeMint for about 12 years and saw firsthand the grind and gruel of elected office, and I have no desire to do that. Palmetto Policy Forum is actually a 501c3 nonprofit. So we are an education organization that does policy research, that goes out and talks to people about the research that we do.
Nonprofit status, did you?
Yeah, we do. We do. We're a C3. So deductions to us are tax exempt. We don't endorse candidates. We don't participate in any kind of partisan politics. We are strictly about the ideas that we're advocating. And that's actually one of the things that I think is exciting about education choice, which is the issue that we've really picked up as kind of our cause celeb this first year, is that there are people across the nation on both sides of the aisle who are embracing this as the civil rights issue of our time, as the way to really pursue equal opportunity for every child. And so that's exciting, to be part of something that really transcends traditional politics in a lot of ways. I don't like to be pigeonholed. And so this allows me some freedom to go out and actually talk about ideas outside of the typical partisan context.
Sure. So, just to be clear, Ellen, you're not running for office.
I am not running for office.
You're not in that group of super people running for superintendent of education.
How many are there, 20, 25? I don't know.
It seems like a lot, yes. And we're getting ready to interview all of them right here on WCRS. I think I'm just going to be able to have a standard checklist of questions.
Yep.
Okay. And then we'll compare them all the way down the line.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
But this is going to be, I mean, just speaking of the race with the number of people that are running, it's going to be hard to be able to single out the person that you as an individual feel most confident that can be superintendent of education, don't you think?
Yeah, no, it definitely is a tough decision when you have a field that is this crowded. And, you know, I would just encourage your listeners to look at the candidates from a perspective of who is talking most about empowering local decision makers as opposed to aggregating more control at the state level, or kind of reinforcing the power of the existing status quo. I think, you know, for too long in South Carolina and too long in America, we have been defending an education system instead of defending the needs of the individual child. And so I would hope that your listeners would take a close look at the candidates and see which of them are supporting the kind of expansion of choices, whether it's charter school or tax credit scholarships or things like that that are going to really give parents, especially parents of special needs children or low-income children, more options with what they can offer their child for their education.
Sure. And, you know, that's at the here's my other trite phrase, at the end of the day, don't you love that one? Everybody uses that one. At the end of the day, it is, if we don't figure out a way to educate our children, we are going to be in serious difficulties when it comes to competing on the international stage.
Absolutely. No, you're right. And that's the thing. We have so much to offer as a state here in South Carolina. And you see how things like our great climate, our very friendly people, our right to work status are continuing to attract companies there, here. But that's not enough. There are other states, Michigan, for example, who would have ever thought Michigan would pass a right to work law? But they realized that that's what they had to do to be competitive. And I remember the first time I came here, we talked about this whole idea of competitive federalism, which is the pressure is on states to be continually improving their policy environment to attract jobs and to attract the kind of economic growth that is going to sustain us as a state. And if we can't provide an educated workforce to fill the jobs that are currently available, how do we think we're going to attract more jobs in the future? I was talking to one major employer who said that they have to interview 11 people to find one minimally qualified candidate. And these
are that's terrible.
For fairly entry-level kind of jobs. And that's a pretty sad indictment of where we are.
And the other thing is how do we teach our children to be capable of learning and keep learning? Because no longer can you go to school, complete your high school, go to 4 years of college and say, okay, I'm done. Mm-hmm. Now you are going to be in a state of perpetual learning.
Yep.
And if we can't get to the basics, reading,
right,
then how can they ever move forward? One of the things that astounded me, I'll just tell you this, I don't know whether you have... that people can forget or can become unlearned in reading.
Mm. Yeah.
I can't imagine that, but that actually happens to our workforce. And then what do? They have to go back through and learn to read again.
Wow.
And try to go forth through our technical schools or whatever the methodology is there.
Yeah, well, no, I think you're right. We have got to equip our kids to be lifelong learners, and that's why reading is something that we've focused on specifically at the forum. When I was here last time, we talked about the research that we had done into the education reforms that they enacted over the last 10 to 15 years in Florida, and a key piece of that Florida platform was a K-3 reading program that really taught teachers, instructed them in the science of reading, which has changed dramatically over the last, 20 years, gave them the support that they needed. It created summer reading camps to kind of stop the brain drain of students who have a gap in 3 months, of the year where they're not really doing anything to continue hone their reading skills. And then, the stopgap at the end of this, the accountability piece, is that if the child is not reading on grade level by the end of third grade, they are actually held back, not just held back to repeat third grade, but held back for intensive reading intervention to get them to grade level so that they then can be promoted on to fourth grade. And there are actually two bills based on that very idea that have passed both the House and the Senate. They're slightly different, and so now they have to go through the process of being reconciled, but we're very hopeful that those might make it out of the State House by the end of the year, because if we don't get reading right, we might as well just pack it up and go home.
Exactly.
They say that at the in the K-3 level,
you were going to say at the end of the day, weren't you?
Yeah, no, of course.
Go ahead, Ellen.
At the end of the day, no.
Yes.
At the K-3 level is when you learn to read, and third grade on is where you read to learn. And if you can't read by the end of the third grade, the Annie E. Casey Foundation and several other organizations have put out studies that show how much less likely you are to graduate from high school and all of the social pathologies that, that translates into. So really, reading is the keystone. I think that's the key that unlocks the door for a lot of the problems that we face.
That's right. And you heard it right here on WCRS. Time for South Carolina Radio News. We'll be right back.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafé cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafé mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. We are talking with Ellen Weaver this afternoon. We're talking about a lot about education, because that is one of the conundrums of the future, is how we're going to do this. And, you know, one of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand, Ellen, is particularly when it comes to the dollars that we spend in our school systems, and students being able to take those dollars and do different things with them. There's a lot of talk about this. Mm-hmm. What does the Palmetto Policy Forum believe on that?
Well, we think that's actually a great idea. I don't know how many people actually know that education spending is 48% of our state budget. The only thing that even comes close to rivaling that is what we spend in health care, a lot of that, you know, for Medicaid and other things.
That's a whole nother topic, dear Ellen.
That's a whole nother topic that we won't get off into. But, you know, almost half of our state budget is education spending. And right now what we're doing is funding a system instead of funding the needs of individual children.
And yet we talk about how much dollars is being spent on each child. And they're all different across the state, which I find that amazing.
Yeah, it really is the disparity between districts. And a lot of that is because the funding system is so hodgepodge as to how much comes from the federal government in, you know, some of the poorer districts versus what's state and what's local. And so the funding formula is a big mess. And that's something that politicians have tried to tackle unsuccessfully a number of times. And so
will that be something that they'll try to tackle this year?
I'm thinking
it's not.
It's
an election
yeah.
year. Hmm. Would that be something yeah. they would look at?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. The typical election year stance is let's just throw some more money at it and go home and call it a day. But I'm encouraged, because I think that there are more and more reform-minded folks who understand that we can't continue to just do what we've always done and think that we're going to improve our results.
Isn't that a definition of insanity?
It is the definition of insanity. And you look at, you know, a state like Florida that we've held up as a model. They went from behind South Carolina in 1998 in nearly all of their test scores to the point where now low-income students in Florida outscore the entire student population of South Carolina on fourth grade reading, which just blows my mind. And since I talked to you last time, we've actually gotten another year of scores in, and the gap has widened. It was just 1 percentage point. It's now 5 percentage points. 66% of low-income students in Florida are reading on grade level at fourth grade, and our entire student population of South Carolina, only 61% are. It's unbelievable.
And how did they do this?
They did it through a whole platform of things, including the reading program that we talked about before. But another big piece of it was introducing choice for families. They have the oldest special needs scholarship program in the nation, called McKay Scholarships. And actually, our special need tax credit scholarship that we have here in South Carolina now is largely modeled after the successful program in Florida. They figured out ways to incentivize teachers, to treat teachers like professionals, to reward the teachers who are making a difference.
What are you saying? What do you mean? We're not just all paying them, and they're not just grandfathered in there year after year?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, let's figure out who is an effective teacher. I think it's probably common sense to everybody, but, you know, that doesn't matter. Academics are going to pay for a study anyway. So there's actually a study that proves that the number one factor that affects student learning.
Yes,
hey, Gracie, is teachers.
Yes. Well, they do affect it. And,
yeah.
you know, and we all remember the teacher, right,
mm-hmm.
who was inspirational
in
our life.
Absolutely.
And that was the one. Maybe they weren't the easiest teacher, were they?
No. They were always the teacher who asked you to do the harder thing and to go further and who pushed you. I have several teachers like that in my life that, looking back, I would not be the person I was today if it wasn't for them. And I think you're right. We all have those teachers. And those
but
are the teachers.
But we have a lot that we just said, oh, I can sleep through this class.
Yeah. And so we need to figure out how we reward teachers who are truly making a difference in the outcomes of their students. The motto should be a year's learning in a year's time as the minimum benchmark of what we expect of our teachers. And the thing is that, you know, a lot of people say, well, aren't you being kind of hard on teachers? They're getting students who have home situations that are difficult, who maybe were coming to school hungry, who have a lot of things outside of school that impact their learning.
Outside issues.
Yeah. And that's absolutely true. You can't expect the teacher to mitigate that. But what you can expect is that the teacher is contributing to the education growth of that student. If they get a student who is 2 or 3 years behind grade level, chances are that student is not going to be fully caught up by the end of that school year, but they should be making progress.
But you know what? They should have never got to that next grade level if they weren't on that grade level that they should be on.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, one of the biggest problems. We have just passed students on, mm-hmm. hoping that somebody else will pick up the slack.
And that's why I think the third grade reading policy that we were talking about is so important in stopping social promotion at the end of third grade. If a child can't read by the end of third grade, I think it's going to be a whole lot less damaging to their self-esteem to get them the intervention that they need in third grade than to watch them drop out when they're 16 because they can't perform in high school.
But the other thing is, we have kids that are reading at age 2 and 3. I mean, I've seen toddlers that I'm just going, oh my God. So how do we even balance that out, Ellen?
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's a lot of people talking about the need for more early childhood education. That's something that we've not done a lot of research on. There are definitely people who take conflicting, you know, opinions on that, who see it as, you know, just more government spending for basically glorified daycare when you're talking about pre-K programs. But I think that you're right. There are things that can be done that actually work. And as long as we're empowering parents to make those choices for their children, I think that it makes sense to take a look at it. Let's get
it's
to the kids as early as we can. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, look at what these kids can do. You hand them a device and they're
flipping through pictures and the whole, yeah, they know how to run the phone better than I do, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of unbelievable.
Scary.
It is. But these are some of the things that as parents are having to look at. And as we look at across the state, we have, as we said, such disparity in the dollars that are spent. How do you come up with what's equitable, Ellen?
That's a tough question, and I'm not sure I can define what is equitable, but I think that the proof is always in the pudding. It's in the outcomes. It's in the level of student achievement. It is in
But we have
parent
some students who are such over, I'm going to say overachievers.
Sure.
Right.
Right.
And then we have the student that can barely keep any interest to stay there day after day.
Right. Well, and that's because maybe that student isn't being challenged. You look at somebody like Bill Gates, who was bored to death in school and, you know, just like totally zoned out. It wasn't because he couldn't learn. It was because he wasn't being engaged according to his unique learning needs. And so I think that's the point of what we're trying to say is that it's not so much in my mind about the dollar amount that you spend. It's about the quality of the option available to the parent to spend it on. I think that funding should follow children instead of funding a system. And you look at, you know, a state like Arizona, where they have this very innovative concept. It's called an education savings account, an ESA. And basically, parents get 90% of the funding that their child that would go to the traditional district. And they can use that money however they want for the educational needs of that child, to the point that any money that they don't spend in a given school year actually accumulates in that account and can be put towards future education expenses, towards paying for college and other things. And so when you actually are empowering parents with decision-making authority, turning them into shoppers, they're going to try to get the best value for their dollar. That's how it works.
Well,
in the rest of life.
That's called consumerism.
Exactly. And parents and students are consumers of education, and we need to treat them like that.
Wow, what a concept, Ellen.
Yeah, kind of novel, right?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, we're here with Ellen Weaver. If you've got a question for her, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back.
Layaway. We've done it for over 30 years here at Sharp Facets Gallery. So whether it's Christmas, a birthday, an anniversary, or just because, we know layaway every day. Come see us today at Sharp Facets Gallery. Need more info? Call us, 229-6613. That's 229-6613.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. It is pretty interesting when you have a video camera going in the same room and you're trying to teach Gracie to be a lady.
Yes.
All right, here we are. We're talking with Ellen Weaver. We're talking about education. We've talked a lot about Common Core. We're talking about maybe we should talk a little bit about education credits and where South Carolina stands on, you know, our special needs. You know, there's a lot of discussions. Should a special needs child be in a regular classroom? How do we educate special needs? What do we do? Because everybody learns different. And you know what we're finding out? There's a lot that special needs children can do in this world. And in the past, having a brother who had Down syndrome, he never lived, I don't think, to his full potential when we see what Down syndrome's children are doing today in this world.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good topic to talk about. What do you think?
I think that's fantastic. You're right. There is so much joy and optimism that children with special needs bring to whatever the task at hand is. I was actually just at a presentation at Cardinal Newman Catholic School in Columbia for one of these new tax credit scholarships that we have for special needs students. And to hear the people at that school talk about the young lady who received this scholarship and just, again, the joy and optimism that she brings, the attitude is infectious that she brings to the classroom. And I think that there is so much opportunity and possibility for these students that we just have to tap into it. And I think, you know, at the forum, we start with the basic philosophy that every child can learn.
Sure.
And so when you start with that philosophy, the question then becomes, so how do we create the environment in which they can learn?
Sure.
And our thought is that parents are the people who are going to know that student best and be best equipped to make a decision about what's going to meet the unique needs of their child. And so that's why we're so excited about this tax credit scholarship that passed as a one-year proviso to the budget last year. It looks like it's going to get extended again this year. And eventually, we'd like to see it become permanent law in South Carolina, but the legislators have decided that, you know, they want to kind of see how it goes, give it a test run for a few years, and I can respect that. But I think that there's a proven track record when you look at Florida, Arizona, and other states that have enacted special needs scholarships for over the last decade and how successful they've been, to the point that, you know, in our research, we actually found that Florida has gained 54 points. Their special needs students have gained 54 points in the last decade, which puts them third in the nation for improvement among their special needs student population. Guess where South Carolina is?
Where's South Carolina, Ellen?
At the very bottom. Thank you for asking that question. We've actually lost in the last decade 43 points on our combined fourth and eighth grade math and reading scores for our special needs students. We are dead last. And that is a travesty. It is absolutely unacceptable. When I think about the lost potential that number represents, it makes me angry.
Sure.
It makes me physically angry. And I think that we have such an opportunity here with this scholarship program to open new avenues for students to get the special education that they need that is going to help them reach their full potential and become productive members of society. So the way that this program works is that individuals and companies can actually donate to approved tax scholarship organizations, which are charitable organizations, and they will receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit up to 60% of their tax liability for those contributions. Those scholarship organizations then turn around and make grants to deserving students for tuition costs at the school of their parents' choice. And several students have actually received these donations. They'll go into effect for the next school year. So this program is very young in South Carolina, but again, it's modeled on programs that have proven successful where they've been tried. So we're very excited, and we hope to see it expanded in years to come.
So this is a benefit. This is rather interesting, Ellen, because we don't reform our tax system here in South Carolina, right? We have a tax code that desperately needs to be revamped.
Sure.
But we now have a tax credit that businesses, and I guess individuals, or is it just businesses?
Individuals as well.
Okay. Can tap into and donate dollars that then will help those with special needs.
That's right. And there's actually an $8 million cap on the program, so it's a very small program right now. We haven't come anywhere near reaching that $8 million cap. But I would encourage your listeners, if they have a child with special needs or if they know of a child with special needs, to visit independented.org, so independented.org. And at that website, they'll find out all about this program. They'll find out about how to contribute to special needs scholarships. They'll find out about how to access that scholarship for their child. I just think it's an incredible program, and it's one that we really want to see grow here in South Carolina, because I think it's a huge first step in addressing that gap, that disparity that we've been talking about.
Sure. I was out at Burton Center last week and had a great time out there, and seeing the joy of our special needs clients out there who want to work, need to learn how to work, and some of them, a great majority of them, are out there actually working is something that you just can't imagine, to see somebody doing a job that is not high thinking, but very important to do for companies like Velux and Fuji.
Yep.
And see them progressing and seeing them looking forward to payday on Thursday, because what do they want to do on Thursday? They want to go out and spend that money.
Heck yeah.
Oh, that's right.
So the American way.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we seem to have forgotten, is that they need this self-fulfillment at whatever level, and that is what we wish for all our children, isn't it?
Absolutely. Work is ennobling. It really is. Work gives us a sense of purpose, and it makes us feel like we're valuable, like we're contributing something. And special needs children have as much a need to feel like they are contributing and being a part of things as a child who learns in the more traditional way. I know we're not movie critics here, but if you're audience wants to be just completely blown away and inspired by the joy that special needs people can find in doing work, there's a movie that Goodwill Industries has put out, and the name is escaping me right now, but just Google Goodwill movie and it will just blow you away if you can find this. I mean, it's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. It will inspire you and just show you how much opportunity there is if only we'll tap into it.
Sure. And that goes for the other side, you know?
Absolutely.
We need all our people, all people, to be able to work too. And regardless of socioeconomic, or regardless of the potential, the brilliance, or the, you know, those children that we love that aren't quite as brilliant. Mm-hmm. Hey, we all have potential. And sometimes it's just unlocking it and finding it.
That's absolutely right. We're all about how do we empower people, and education and hard work are the two. I think Tim Scott said that, you know, the closest thing we have to magic is education and hard work. And those are two things that we unapologetically advocate for here at the Forum. We want to help every South Carolinian reach their full potential.
Sure. And when you take a person like Tim Scott, mm-hmm. who was single parent, and he started, how can you, that is like the great American story, isn't it?
It's everything that we're talking about. You know, he talks about how his grandfather could hardly read, he would sit at the kitchen table and hold the newspaper every day. Yeah. And just to provide a role model for his grandsons. And I think that, you know, there is just so much power in seeing a story like Senator Scott's. And I think that we are very fortunate to have someone like that advocating for the kind of education choices that you and I have been talking about today. He's really made that a key piece of his platform, and we're excited to see that.
Absolutely. You know, he is giving the graduation at Lander University. Ah. He is the primary speaker there.
Fantastic.
About that?
Oh, yeah. Those students are in for a treat.
Absolutely, they are. Let's see, Ellen, we had a question come in. Let me see. Ellen said 48% of the state budget goes for schools. Does that include county taxes? reporting taxes for schools, or is it the money in addition to the 48%?
The county money would be in addition. That's just the state budget, what the state itself spends on education. So that doesn't take into account all of the money that the federal government would spend or that would occur at the county level. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's pretty mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's why people need to get engaged in this issue. That's your tax money. Half of your tax money is being spent in a system where half of our children are not reading on grade level. And that's simply unacceptable.
It is. It is. And that's a great point call in and kind of have to close out the show with here, is that it is our money. And we have a tendency to forget that. I tell you another one that I love is when somebody gets a grant, something like that, you know, it's still tax dollars. Mm-hmm. A lot of it comes from tax dollars. Not all of it, because individuals and companies do set up grant money.
Right.
But stuff that comes from the federal government, from the state government, it's our tax dollars.
Mm-hmm. And our goal, my goal as a conservative, is not to be stingy and deny people opportunity, which is, you know, what the other side always says, oh, you just want to cut services. You want to starve children and, you know, keep people down. No. I want to make sure that the money that we're spending is used to the greatest possible effect to empower people. And that means that we have to reconsider how we're spending that money and do it in a better way.
You are absolutely right. Well, you know what, Ellen? You couldn't have timed that better, because guess what? It's 4:59 and almost 5 o'clock. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Ellen Weaver, President and CEO of Palmetto Policy Forum. Thanks so much for coming out. Tell us again the website if people want to check out some information.
Absolutely. PalmettoPolicy.org. Ann, it's been great to be with you.
We'll look forward to having you back again. Gracie, you were moderately good today. All right, everybody. Bye-bye.